Well, my parents have retired. They're in their 60s. They were in New Zealand earlier this year, and they love their time there. I love any New Zealanders here. Oh, yes, great. Great to have you here. I love New Zealand. Some of my great friends are New Zealanders. They were going to leave the country, and they were invited to have chicken with people. And it wasn't just one person. That was several people were inviting them to have chicken. And this really excited my mum because she thought she'd hit the jackpot. She loves a cultural experience. And she thought this was one of those moments where she gets to share chicken with all the New Zealanders. As it turns out, she was at the airport. They were being invited to check in. Got to check in. Check in. It sometimes takes a while to adjust to new ways of speaking. That's one thing. As we move from the first half of Daniel to the second half of Daniel, things change a lot. We move from all those classic stories of Daniel in the lion's den, his friends in the fiery furnace. And then when we get to chapter 7, we get all these strange visions, and it continues that way for most of the rest of the book. And so often from chapter 7 onwards, Christians can often give up, right? They love the old stories, but then they give up on the rest of the book because they find it a bit too difficult. But that would be a mistake. The book of Daniel is one book, and it teaches the people of God how to live wisely when living under an oppressive empire. How to live wisely under an oppressive empire. Now, we might not live in an oppressive empire when compared with the Babylonian empire that Daniel lived under, but I wonder how you feel about living in modern Australia. Do you feel marginalised as a Christian? Our freedom of speech is under threat. We have progressive laws about euthanasia, about abortion, about gender. And all of these things weigh heavily on us as Christians. And according to some people, we are simply nothing more than a species of monkey. Which makes what we're doing today fairly strange, doesn't it? Sitting still on chairs, listening to someone speak for half an hour. No jumping over chairs, at least not yet. No picking off each other's fleas. All right, I haven't seen anyone doing that yet. And yet many claim that's all we are. We're just primates, still just another beast. However, as Christians, we've learned, haven't we, that God has made a wonderful world with an order about it. We've come to learn that from the beginning, we've been made not as mere beasts, but to be rulers over the beasts and over all creation. We see that in Genesis 1. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish of the sea, the birds in the sky, and over every living creature that moves on the ground." So what's it mean to be human? Well, here it's to be like God in being a ruler over the creation. That's what it means to be human, to rule the world under him. And so when we throw off God's authority over us, when we ignore God's authority over our lives and decide that we get to call the shots, that we get to live for our own pleasure, to run the show ourselves, well, we've become ironically unlike God. We've become more like the beasts who serve themselves. At that point, we've become no different from the beasts. We've become beasts ourselves. We see that in Genesis 3. And this explains what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. You've already looked at chapter 4 together. He was the greatest of Babylon's kings. Like Adam, he's described as very much a ruler over creation. We see that in chapter 4. But what did Nebuchadnezzar do? He despised God's authority over it. It went to his head, the authority and power that he had. He used his power brutally. He acted like a beast. God then humiliates him for a time, and then God graciously restores him, rehumanizes him, and gives him the glory of the King of Heaven. We see that in Daniel 4 and Daniel 5. And so the beast then, for the rest of the book of Daniel, now takes on this symbolic nature of human power gone astray. That's what it means to be a beast. Human rule in rebellion against God. Of kingdoms that rule by tyrannical and destructive power. And that's what we see in the first 8 verses of Daniel. Now, we have to remember when we come to this language that it's not like the same kind of literature you've been looking at in the first few chapters, okay? Here's three things about apocalyptic literature that may be helpful for us as to guide us in our thinking. Firstly, it's that the language is highly symbolic. So when we read about these creatures coming out of the sea, you're not meant to picture that Pacific Rim movie. I don't know if you've seen that movie. We've got great creatures coming out of the sea, as if that's what Daniel is talking about here. Every element in the picture is meant to be symbolic. So the fact that the creatures come out of the sea for the Jewish people is symbolic of chaos and evil. For us, it's beach and, you know, having a great time and holidays. But not for Daniel. For Daniel, the sea is chaos. It's evil. It's terrible. It's fearful. So the symbolic nature of the language is something we firstly need to take on board. The second is that the key to apocalyptic literature is that it's the big picture that matters. You need to see the forest through the trees. Don't get caught up in all the detail. That's not something to worry about. The big picture is the thing that matters. And the third thing that would help to guide us is that it always has a purpose, okay? And the purpose of this literature is to help the people of God live wisely and trust God when living in an oppressive situation in a tyrannical empire. And so we're introduced to these beasts, aren't we? First, we meet the terrifying lion eagle beast, okay, and verse 4. Now, you've seen lions on TV and that sort of thing, or from behind fences. If you've been to the zoo, that sort of thing, or you might have been inside of a car when you've seen a lion. But for those who lived where lions lived, lions weren't a spectacle of fun, right? They weren't there for entertainment. It's a scary thing to come face to face with a lion, and likewise with the rest of these beasts. They're fearful. Notice how Daniel is terrified at the start of this. And so sometimes we read this literature and we find it funny, right? There's lots of jokes you can make about these beasts, but you need to remember all the way along that this is a terrifying image that Daniel's experiencing. It's fearful. And we see that all the way along. Second thing we see there is that the lion eagle beast is humanized. Okay, this is the strange thing that happens. Its wings are ripped off and it's raised up to stand on 2 feet. And it's given the heart of a man, did you see? Now, if you've already read Daniel 4 at this point, then you can't help but be reminded of the story of Nebuchadnezzar, the great, ruthless, powerful, arrogant, beastly conqueror who destroys God's temple, brings Israel into captivity. But then if you remember, he's humbled by God and becomes this humanized ruler again, de-winged, de-clawed, defanged, a ruler who comes to acknowledge God's rule over him and encourages others to do so as well. The beast has become a man. He's been humanized. Truly in the image of God, ruling over creation as God intends. And so this beast becomes symbolic of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, the key to identifying the rest of the beasts is not to read this vision and then run to your history books, right, to work out which beast would line up with which one. I think the key to discovering what each one symbolizes is to read the book of Daniel as a whole. Because not only the chapters that we've already read, chapters 1 to 6, are keys to understanding the beast, but also the chapters yet to come. I think the remaining chapters of Daniel function a little bit like when you load an image on your computer screen and your internet's really slow. And what happens? First of all, you just get all these pixels and you can't really make out what's going on. That's like Daniel chapter 7. We've got these pixels. But as you read on in subsequent chapters, the pixels turn into a picture. You actually make sense of who the beasts are. So I'm not going to spoil the thunder of the following chapters to work out how I've come to these conclusions, but really to give you a hint here. So the lopsided rib-eating bear beast we see in verse 5, he's huge, powerful, ravenous. He's a taste for flesh. Still got the last kill in his mouth. He's got a taste for ribs. He's probably represents the people of the Persians and the Medes, right? Represented by his lopsidedness, one side stronger than the other. Then we see the four-headed, four-winged, speedy leopard beast, another terrifying beast, the swiftest of all the predators. I think the clues to understanding him come up in the next chapter. He's speedy, okay? He can attack from any direction, multiple jaws, multiple paws. I sound like a Dr. Seuss novel here. But this creature is a beastly weapon of mass destruction. And later on, I think we discover that this is Alexander the Great, right? And so if you know the story of Alexander the Great and the Greek Empire, he conquered the kingdom with lightning speed. Well, that's three beasts. But what you need to notice here is something really important, and that's that where these beasts get their authority from. Did you notice that in verse 6? This beastly, rebellious, anti-God kingdom was given authority to rule. Get up and eat your fill of flesh, he's told. You see, no matter how bad things get, and this should reassure us, no matter how bad things get, no matter how dark things seem for the people of God, God has not lost control. The authority to rule the wicked kingdoms of this world is given by God. That's wonderfully reassuring because it means that if he's given it, well, then he can take it away. And he does, and he will. And so part of the looking at the big picture here, what we see is empire after empire after empire. And yet all the way along, we're told, despite how terrifying and horrible that might be to live in that kind of condition, God is in control. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. Then we come to this final, most terrifying beast, and he kind of stands out. He's kind of the mother of all the beasts in some ways. He stands out in a kind of different category. He's the biggest and baddest and meanest of them, like a feral wolverine, iron teeth, right? He's got bronze claws, all this metal, devouring, crushing, trampling. I don't even know where you could fit 10 horns. But then it becomes obvious again that the language is all symbolic because the horns get squeezed out and there's a super horn comes up amongst from the midst. It's horrible. We're meant to be repulsed by it. Can you imagine a kingdom, a ruler, represented by such a terrifying image? Who is this super horn? Well, I think, as I say again, if we read the rest of the book, his name becomes clear. It's Antiochus. We're talking about Antiochus the Fourth. He's the next in a succession of kings that came from the Seleucid Empire. Yep, that'll do. From the Seleucid Empire, people that ruled over Palestine and Syria. And he gave himself a particular title. He called himself Antiochus Epiphanes. Which means, Antiochus, God made manifest. That's what he liked people to think about him. Antiochus Epiphanes, God made manifest. In fact, he was so sure of this that he made a statue of the god Zeus and he set it up in the Jerusalem temple, the temple of God. The thing about the statue was that it actually drew a striking resemblance to himself, right? He wanted to people to get the message, I am a god. The other thing we see in Antiochus is that the people of God go on to experience some of the worst persecution that the Jewish people ever experienced at an intensity never before experienced. The three previous beastly kingdoms had ultimately been under God's rule, but this one seemed a bit different. He was going further, overreaching, competing seemingly with God himself, with arrogant boasts and demands. But appearances can be deceiving, as we're about to see. See, there is real hope in God's unstoppable kingdom. In the darkest moments of human history, there is hope. Human power will not continue on unchecked. Kingdoms, nations, governments, rulers, our government will have to give an account to God. The arrogant will be humbled. That's good news, isn't it? The court will convene, the Ancient of Days will take his seat, and God will bring his judgment. I wonder if you'd notice what's absent from that picture that we see in the middle of Daniel there, where the Ancient of Days takes his seat. You see, despite the power and severity of these fearsome kings, these terrifying emperors, notice that there's no final seesawing battle between good and evil between them. Did you notice that? You see, there is a clash of kingdoms of sorts here, but it is a pretty one-sided clash, isn't it? Did you notice that God the Most High, the Ancient of Days, simply turns up and sits down? It reminds me of when I was a kid, and I have a younger brother who's a couple of years younger than me, and we'd be wrestling, and I'd slam my brother into a wall, and he'd have me in the headlock or something like that, and Dad would walk into the room and sit down. And that's all he needed to do. At that point, you know it's all over. And so, as here, God turns up and everyone drops their weapon. The fight is over. You know who's in power in this room, right? The court's now in session. The book's opened. The beast is just disposed of. There's no battle. Body destroyed, thrown into the fire. How can this be? Well, Darius had already discovered the truth in the previous chapter. It's on the screen there. For he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions. This is the God we are talking about. The kingdoms of this world have nothing on him. God's kingdom won't end, but it is delegated to another, did you notice? Verses 13 to 14. Instead of a beastly rule of sinful humans, those intoxicated by their own power, there's instead this assurance that humanity will one day rule as humanity was meant to rule. Over creation. Power is rehumanized. Verses 13 and 14. In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. So it's there. Who is this guy? You see, all the other empires are beastly, aren't they, in the vision? They're animalistic. But this one starts as a human. When God created the heavens and the earth, he created the world to be a place of affectionate relationships, of people living according to God's good order. And the animals were meant to live in fellowship with the humans. There was an order. God, ruler over all, humans, made in his image, rulers over the beasts, over the rest of creation. These beastly empires represent all that has been corrupted and messed up. The beast ruling over and terrifying the humans in tyrannical rule, oppressive regime after oppressive regime, each and every one defying the God who made them. But here, this one like a son of man, is power is rehumanized. Because this Son of Man, he's led into the presence of the Ancient of Days, right? If you're led into the presence of a king in these cultures, it means you have great importance. He's given a procession. What else has he given? He's given authority, glory, sovereign power. All nations and peoples and every language worshipped him. You see, this is a greater kingdom that's ever been seen before. Nebuchadnezzar tried to get all the peoples and nations to worship him in chapter 3, if you remember. But he had to command them to do it, if you remember. And it didn't last long, and it didn't work. But these people, nations, people of different languages, same language as chapter 3, they voluntarily give themselves to offer themselves in worship to him. They just do it. And they're worshiping a human. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, a kingdom that will never end. It's a picture of the world that's been brought back into order as God has designed it. The beastly kingdom's all subdued. Order is restored and he's given authority, right? Who is this one? Well, we're actually given an interpretation of who this one is later in the chapter in verses 26 and 27, but the court will sit and his power, is it on there? No, it's not. His power will be taken away. Have a look, verse 26 and 27. It's talking about the horn, the little horn. His power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever. Then, verse 27, the sovereignty, power, and greatness of all the kingdoms under heaven will be handed over to who? The holy people of the Most High. Notice how the interpretation of the vision is a bit puzzling here. The authority and power is given to the holy people of the Most High. Notice then it goes back to the singular. Did you see that? Verse 27, his kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom and all rulers will worship and obey him. Now, for us, this might be puzzling, but in this culture that we're talking about, the Jewish culture, there was a common understanding that the king and his people always go together. What's true for the king is true for the people. If a king is given rule, his people share in that rule. This is a king who will not be without his people. In the middle of all the terror, the turmoil, the chaos, the corruption, the visions of wrath and of judgment, there is the Son of Man, someone to whom God will give authority to rule, and the king who will not be without his people. Well, Weber's already given the game away, hasn't he? You know who it is. It's Jesus, isn't it? That's who we're talking about. And that's what we read when we read the gospel narrative of what happens in Jesus' life. When Jesus prays in Mark 14, 34 to 36, he's in deep distress. He's about to face execution. He's about to go to the cross and he prays, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. But Father, everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but what you will." Jesus prays in the lead up to his death that the cup of God's wrath might be taken from him. So sorrowing to the point of death. He prays that the cup might be taken, and yet he commits himself to drinking this cup, did you notice? Why does he do that? Because the king will not be without his people, right? "I'm going to save my people," he says. "I'm going to take their wrath for them." As we move on in the narrative, the passion narrative, when Jesus is put on trial, the high priest interrogates Jesus, right, and sticks it to him. "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? Are you the one who Daniel 7 spoke of, right? The one we saw coming, who receives unprecedented authority and rule. Are you that one? Are you really saying that's you, Jesus?" Jesus says, "I am. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." "Yes, I am the Daniel son of man," he says. and you will see me ruling like this. Which would be an astoundingly arrogant claim, unless it were true. And then at noon, Jesus, he hangs there. He goes to the cross. The whole land goes dark. In the previous chapter, Mark 13, Jesus had drawn on the language of Daniel in reference to Antiochus and his great persecution to describe his own death. He'd used that language. He called it the abomination that causes desolation. And I think Jesus is re-envisaging that language to speak of his own death. Can you imagine anything more abominable? Can you imagine anything more desolating? Anything more sacrilegious? Anything more horrific than God's own Son, the eternal Son, conspired against and brutally, torturously executed, publicly disposed of? That's an abomination. That's a desolation. The one who made the world their creator, they didn't recognize him. Worse, they turned against him and crucified him. It's an unimaginable abomination. There's never been a more abominable abomination. There's never more been a more desolating desolation. And Jesus cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? With a loud cry, Jesus cries his last. And in the moments of Jesus' death, those terrifying realities of brutal, power-hungry tyrants like Antiochus Epiphanes, all that judgment and wrath in which God's people are also caught, to which we contribute, of which we experience, the weight of the terrifying empires, the rebellion that's in our own heart and rouses God's judgment, all of it gets focused and funneled into one man in this one moment. And at that moment, the Roman who's standing by, the soldier, he says, surely this man was the Son of God. Why? Because the king will not be without his people. So he takes their wrath for them in their place. But he doesn't stay dead. He rises again from the dead. And we read about this in Acts chapter 1, where he's taken up before the eyes of the disciples. I don't know if you remember that scene. He's taken up and a cloud hid him from their sight. And finally, it's at this point that the Son of Man approaches the Ancient of Days. You see, Daniel's vision is one in heaven. And if you are standing before the flaming throne chariot of God with thousands upon thousands worshipping him, you would have seen clouds and one like the Son of Man coming up towards you, coming to the Ancient of Days to receive authority and glory and sovereign power and the worship of every nation and people and language. Where is Jesus gone? The one who took upon himself the full venting of God's wrath? He's now received power from the Ancient of Days. This same Jesus, says the angel in Acts 1, this same Jesus has been taken from you into heaven, will come back in the same way you've seen him go. Well, let's draw out some implications for ourselves. We live living in our time. What does it look like to live in our time? Well, we live in a world that's of a bit of an odd character. In some parts of the world, Christians can be marked down the beach and asked if they want to convert to Islam, and if they don't, they can be brutally executed. Right? That's the world that we live in. While we can spend our time here in blissful safety without any fear of being marched anywhere. So the first thing here is we need to remind ourselves that this freedom that we have is a rare privilege in human history to live in our time. I wonder how you feel about the secularization of Australia. I wonder how you feel about the threat of Islamic state power. I wonder how you feel about the way human power is being abused in our culture, the war against family, the war against gender distinctions, the war against God-given sexuality. Do you find that unsettling? Do you find that unnerving? I certainly do. I find it hard to face. Daniel 7 tells me the verdict, though. God's kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. The Ancient of Days will take his seat. The books will be opened, and every human power that oppresses the people of God will be judged with a fierce and decisive judgment. So what do you do when you're faced with a beast? Well, you remember that God is in control of human history, right? We need to be reassured by that. God's power is unimaginable and limitless. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. God wants us to see that the way of wisdom is to persevere in trusting the Ancient of Days to bring his judgment, and that all of creation is under his rule. Nothing, and not even death itself, can put you beyond the reach of God's love. That's a great comfort to us when we struggle with doubts, weaknesses, sins, times when we feel like we can't hold on anymore. Feels like our sins are getting the better of us and we're losing. All these things are dwarfed by the stature of God's power. God remembers the names of each one of his people, and he's recorded them in a book. And there'll come a day when he'll read your name, and even if you're dead, you will come to life again to join God in everlasting joy, because in wisdom you heeded his call upon your life. On that day there'll be others who hear their name read, and they'll be ashamed because they will see with great clarity how they foolishly neglected God's call upon their life. We need to persevere as Christians. We need to help others persevere. And perhaps the most powerful way we can do that is by praying for each other. Okay? Praying for each other. Pray for missionaries. Pray for Isaac. Pray for his mission on campus. A friend came up to me the other day at church and he said, listen, Alan, I'm sorry that we're not in a financial position to support you at the moment, but you know what? Our family prays for you every Thursday, right? Every Thursday morning we pray for you. And that was just such a joy for me to hear that, right? Someone praying. There's the power of God at work in his life. They're the prayers that we need to make the mission happen on campus. Wouldn't that be a great thing if, as a result of this morning, you went home and committed to praying for Isaac, right? Once a week, doesn't have to be a long, lengthy prayer, but pray for him. Pray for his mission on campus. Pray that people might hear about Jesus and be saved. We need to help him to persevere. We need to help others to persevere. We live in a bizarre time. If we did what we are doing here today in North Korea, the national police would burst in, they would guard the exits, Weber, myself and anyone else in leadership here would be dragged off to a prison camp, and none of us would ever be seen again. There is a story about one church in North Korea where the doors burst open, the police rushed in, the people in the congregation, they were singing, and what they did is they looked into each other's eyes because they knew that at that moment nothing could be done. They looked at each other and they willed each other to be strong enough, and they prayed for each other that they'd be strong enough to persevere as followers of the crucified and risen King Jesus. Simplest and most basic way they can express their determination to persevere and to encourage brothers and sisters to persevere. There's no worldly power or resource available to them but the grace of God and their ability to express that unity with each other. But looking to each other's eyes as they sang, they could sing knowingly that the risen Jesus had come to the Ancient of Days, that Jesus now rules, and that Jesus will come again.